We continue our meeting. I had neglected to say that Amaro was a little bit indisposed to today, so he's not with us. We continue our deliberations on the disclosure initiative. We're starting with paper 11C. Is it Eduardo?
11E, sorry.
Oh, 11E, sorry.
Which
one? 11E. So, Holder?
Yeah. Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everybody. Agenda paper 11E talks about the content of the notes, and just to put this in context of the previous session and where's the difference, where are the comments, I think this paper really discussed about what a general disclosure standard as a replacement for IS1 should really include in context of what the notes are all about, so the kind of role of the notes, and then also to what extent also a general disclosure standard should include objectives. And this paper highlights that we think there could be two different objectives, and obviously that might be depending on the route you're taking on or which approach you're taking, this might have also implications for an overall review. But I think it is very clear that we would like to discuss in this paper really the kind of implications that should be considered for a general disclosure standard for preparers, so meaning a replacement for IS1. This paper is also a follow-up paper on previous discussion last year. The paper, first of all, highlights what we discussed previously and also highlights that some of the concerns that board members expressed in context of not the role of the notes, but what we actually describe as a kind of binary split between explanatory and supplementary information. And this paper highlights that we think and we reconsider whether it's really necessary to make this kind of split between explanatory and supplementary. We think it is not really necessary, or it's not necessary, but I think it's very helpful to describe what the notes are doing. So therefore, the kind of first recommendation in this paper is to reconfirm the kind of role of the notes, but not really making this, let's say, split between explanatory and supplementary information in a general disclosure standard, but just explaining, as highlighted in paragraph 24, that the role of the notes in meeting the objective of financial statements is to explain the information presented in the primary financial statements and to supplement the primary financial statements with additional information not depicted in those statements that is necessary to meet the objectives. I don't know whether we want to stop here and see whether board members have some issues with this kind of recommendation, or I could also go through to the next question and discuss all the things together. I think it's a kind of preference.
Mary?
Holger, could I just give you a piece of feedback on it? And I can't remember whether it relates to the paper as a whole or this piece in particular, which is I agree, but I think this is another place where a few more words in the standard would be more valuable than paring it down to just what you have in 24A and B, because I think if we just say this, it's very abstract, and if you haven't followed the discussion, hard to pull what you mean from that. So I would go on to say, you know, with supplement, for example, it's items that don't meet, it's risk management, it's, for example, as two examples, and not list everything that explain or supplement means, but provide at least a couple of examples that brings those generic words to life so that somebody reading that at the beginning says, okay, I get what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Philippe?
I wonder whether the description that you have in 24A and B is not a little bit too restrictive. Because you start with explain the information presented, and then you continue with additional information to meet that objective. What about information that is necessary to be understood by an investor which is not presented? Let's take a related party transaction. Related party information is not necessarily presented in the financial statements, but need to be understood to properly use the information presented. Is it covered by B in 24? Not really, because B is circular. It always goes back to the objective of explaining what is presented. So I think I would open it a little bit more, saying information that is presented or which is necessary to be understood.
I could reply to this. We try to put more color on this to these words in this kind of next discussion about the set of objectives and the related disclosures that should be included in the general disclosure standard. But we have developed two different approaches where you could, or how you could put more color to this kind of wording about the role of the nodes. And depending on what approach you would prefer, it would be clearly linked back to this kind of this kind of, let's say, description, what the role should be for the nodes.
Yes, but both approaches would be both based on this 24AB principle, which I think is a bit too restrictive. So whatever approach we have to apply this concept, if the objective is too restrictive, that will not help me.
I mean, just to clarify, in 24B, to meet that objective is the objective of financial statements, not...
That is confusing, because to me, yes, when I read it, it sent me back to A. And actually, it's not, it's misreading on my part.
Yeah, so I think we need to just repeat the objective of financial statements.
Yeah, okay.
And that sort of tries to bring in the idea that notes also, you know, the residual piece, in effect, if you've got an objective for financial statements, notes pick up the extra stuff that the primary financial statements don't provide. Okay. But we would clarify that language.
All right.
Point.
Doug? Yes, on this very point, I think to make clear the role of the node is really important because it relates to everywhere, especially about materiality. I have a question about the paragraph 23A. Paragraph 23B. Yeah. And the information, paragraph 23A, I'm sorry. The information about items that meet the definition of an element but have not been recognized. So at that point, are we going to have a different threshold of materiality of recognition to the primary statement and the note? I mean, we are using the same wording, disclosure, and then disclosed on the primary financial statement and disclosing in the note could be different in terms of aggregation. That is what we are going to discuss in the 11C. However, my question is, in terms of recognition, do we have different thresholds? So that is, I'm a bit confused.
I think that one's straight out of paragraph 13, which is the conceptual framework ED.
Yeah.
Kind of, they're just repeating what we'd agreed before.
Right.
Maybe just to give my personal view on this, as far as I would see it, is you would develop recognition and measurement process, and if you think something is not really qualifying for recognition and measurement, but the information is still relevant,
right?
But it would not be relevant in a kind of quantitative way, but you could actually consider some other disclosures that give you, for example, typical litigation issues, where you have a litigation case where the outcome could be really dangerous for your entity, but you do not recognize this because, at the moment at least, the kind of requirements would not really allow you to recognize this. But I think users would like to see this information in the notes, and therefore you would actually provide some relevant information in the notes, so therefore there's also disclosure about not recognized elements.
Right. So I know, I understand the point Ian raised, and I do understand that. However, my concern is we are going to discuss the materiality threshold, and we are going to discuss the aggregation issue, and then we refer to the role of the node. So if we mix up all these things, it would give some impression that we have different threshold of materiality of just recognition.
Yes, but as far as I understand from a conceptual framework project, you would have the recognition criteria more in this kind of qualitative information for recognition and relevance and faithful representation. And
right.
If the board decides it would not qualify for recognition, then it would be part of the board's decision also to consider whether the entity shall provide additional information for specific scenarios.
My understanding is this one not only relate to materiality.
I understand.
Decision we in 37 relate to lawsuit and other non-recognized assets is based on not materiality, but relevance or prudence and other reasons. So we may have something, the standard clearly say that not recognized, but on the other hand say that you should disclose some information. This one is not only materiality.
The next thing is that, as indicated, we think this kind of binary split between explanatory and supplementary, we do no longer recommend this. But I think what we really think it's necessary is to set a kind of central set of disclosure objectives also for a general disclosure standard. And I think we could see from the staff perspective this would not only help preparers but also the ISB in a way to get a kind of anchor for developing some disclosures in particular standards, but also would be very helpful for preparers, because if you're linking back this to the more general objectives that are actually in place in IS1 or in a general disclosure standard, it would give you much more understanding why the disclosure is there. And also, I think we just heard this from previous discussion, if you include, let's say, a kind of set of central set of objectives, it would also help you to avoid redundancy of objectives in many different standards. So therefore, it could also very help you to streamline your writing about disclosure requirements if you just say, okay, we have these kind of more sub-objectives in the general disclosure standard, and therefore we don't need to repeat this in particular standards, we can just refer to the general disclosure standard. Therefore, this is the staff recommendation that a general disclosure standard should have a central set of disclosure objectives included. However, the staff has developed two different views or two different approaches how we could set this kind of objectives for a general disclosure standard. And one approach, the first approach, is something that was also more consistently with the discussion in the conceptual framework project, is where you would typically provide the type of information that would be part of the content of the notes and derive from the type of information also what is the purpose of this information. And therefore, it is also very similar what the FASB has developed. We illustrate this in Appendix A, where you have a kind of list of typical types of information, and you would then also link this kind of type of information with the objective that this information should be achieved. And we also included, I think, in paragraph 33, a table that should give you a kind of sense and starting point how it could look like, you know, what type of information you would actually see in the notes, and then also link this kind of type of information with the kind of purpose, what's this information really achieve. However, there are some concerns. We also listed this beside the benefits. We also listed the kind of concerns with this kind of approach. And therefore, we also developed an alternative approach where we think the driving part is really in the first place to have an objective, and this, from these objectives then to develop the kind of information that would fulfill this kind of objective. And the second approach would be really more a kind of, you know, the first section would be, you know, you have an objective to achieve an understanding of measurement and recognition process. So typically this kind of information about the preparation of financial statements. However, then there would be a kind of section where we think what are really kind of sub-objectives for better prospects and future cash flows of the entity. And therefore, we considered something that we also have seen from some entities also doing now in their kind of streamlining efforts for the nodes, that they're focusing more on the activity of the entity. So we would say there would be an objective to provide information that is relevant to understand the operating and investing activities, including operating segments, operating capacity of the entity, and also business combination. The other thing would be also relevant information to understand the financing activity of the entity, including liquidity disclosure objective and solvency, as well as capital management and capital structure. And we also think business combination, taxation and discontinued operation would be some separate sets where I think would be also kind of objectives for notes disclosures. And of course, this also linked back to this kind of risk and uncertainty and persistency disclosure for related cash flows from these activities. And then of course, we would also have in this approach a kind of third section where you say this kind of objective is really with the related information that is mainly to achieve management stewardship. And we are listed here that you would typically see this kind of related party transactions and management compensation and other things where you say, well, they may also serve for better making prospects for future cash flows, but the main objective is really management stewardship. And therefore, so this is actually something where we try to illustrate in Appendix B how it could look like in the general disclosure standard. But of course, we also indicating in the kind of, let's say, views what would be the benefits or the concerns of such an approach is that we think this kind of approach would be a very radical and new approach. It would be a fundamental change. On the other side, you could also think it would but not be that new, because I think the board actually considered now something in IS 7 that the kind of disclosure for reconciliation of items that result in financing activities. So it is already a kind of link to this kind of approach where you're thinking more on the activity side rather than for a particular item. Because we also highlight in this that the main difference, I think, or the key characteristic of approach two would be that for this kind of disclosure for prospecting future cash flows and management stewardship, you should not really try to redevelop the same disclosure in particular standards, but maybe having more common disclosures. And we listed this in Appendix C and D, give you some examples that we think are very good examples to illustrate how the impact might be of this approach. So the example we choose was, for example, here the kind of restriction information about asset restriction of the entity. So is it really necessary to repeat in every standard that the entity has some restrictions about property, plant, equipment, intangible assets, investment property, and so on? Or is it really maybe better to have a single disclosure objective and say, okay, the entity shall disclose information about asset restrictions and then also giving why you give this information? So we think it could also streamline the kind of disclosure guidance compared to current guidance, because I think in current IFRS, it's quite often that very similar disclosures are repeated again and again. And therefore, so this could actually be also a kind of way to avoid this kind of very lengthy shopping list in particular standards. So you could actually consolidate and streamline this kind of disclosures. But of course, we highlighted also in the paper, it would be a very fundamental new approach. And therefore, there might be also very some very strong concerns that this might be a very extensive exercise and not really achievable in the short term. But on the other side, I think it could also give you a kind of way to make the review successively and maybe starting with one point and then, you know, I'm completing this over a longer time of period. But I think this is, I think, one of the options we also considered as a possible approach. And I'm happy to take any questions on this if you have further questions. But of course, we have two questions on this. First of all, whether you agree that a general disclosure standard should have a more central set of objectives included. And then also the last question on our side would be to you whether you would have preference for one approach of this, or whether you want to say for a discussion paper, we should not really include both, but just one or another one. So therefore, I would like to open the discussion.
So
I don't really object to the ideas in here or to including both ideas to get comments on them in a discussion paper, but I did agree with the comment that Steve made in the previous session about if we move to a more sort of objectives-based approach, that it's probably safest in terms of making sure we're actually achieving the objectives we set out to achieve if we sort of do it in, you know, one place, see how that works, and then roll it out. And I guess my only question for you would be, if we were to go with this approach, which is sort of more of a general standard and then linking in with specific requirements, whether it would be possible to do that staged approach, because it feel like if you've got a sort of general disclosure standard with this sort of more objective-based approach, which I don't disagree with as a concept, but then you've got all of these specific standards that have got very specific requirements that might not link in with that overarching approach. I'm not sure, sort of from a mechanical perspective, how that all ties in and whether we could then sort of as easily sort of test the change in approach to see if it works before we branch out with it, or am I misunderstanding?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's really something that this kind of, I don't want to say transition, but I think it is really the best way how to include something in a general disclosure standard that gives you already a kind of future perspective where you want to go, but at the same time and make it compatible with the existing disclosures. We see this issue, and this might be an issue where we have to think about more further. But on the other side, I think because we have heard from constituents that a more fundamental approach would be necessary to overcome the kind of concerns that they have with current approaches, that we in first place develop what we think could be a kind of more holistic or more general approach on disclosures. And of course, then we have this kind of legacy of existing disclosures, and how to deal with this, I think it's a very tricky question.
And I think the fact that, if I understand correctly, the sort of proposed status as a standard maybe makes that also trickier, whereas if it were in its nature more like a sort of, I don't want to go there, but sort of a framework for disclosure, so more that sort of status where it was more clear that this was sort of the background, but the specific requirements and standards were the sort of more specific, that maybe that would be easier. But just
yeah, absolutely. And I think also in context of the second approach, I think we also highlighted that the second approach might result in this kind of thinking that you need to have a kind of separate disclosure standard for financing activities. But on the other side, I think it would be fair to say that in context of this kind of IS7 amendments, if you think really whether this reconciliation fits into IS7 or there's a better place, I think there's no better place at the moment. But obviously, if you have the chance to make a kind of separate standard for financing activity disclosures, I think it would be the first place to go into.
Ian?
Yes, thanks. In paragraph 29, you set out, you know, sort of the two alternatives. And I'd see A as sort of principle-based and B as more structured. And going back to our discussion with the New Zealanders, where there was sort of some opinions that users and maybe preparers as well would prefer some sort of structure. I just think in B, you've taken it a bit far and gone to an extreme. I think we should look at both approaches, but view them, one as principle, one as structured, and then try to think how much structure we could put in. But it may not lead to operating, investing and financing. It may lead to some other sort of structure. And I don't think we should make that assumption at the beginning. And going down to that extreme does give you really difficult implementation questions, I think. So I'm happy to look at the two approaches, but I'd modify a bit the approach B.
But is the first approach really so principle-based? Because I thought it was pretty detailed. And
more checklist-like than the second approach, no?
I think you can do both approaches very principle-based. Yeah. And if you also look to the example or the Appendix C, what would be the example for the second approach, I think it's a very objective and principle-based guidance. So you can do both approaches very objective and principle-based. However, I think the most clearly difference, I think, if I express this correctly, is that in the second approach, it's really this kind of focus. You should not really redevelop the similar disclosures for particular standards. So I think this is kind of concern. If you redevelop, for example, disclosure about assets restrictions, we see this in current guidance that there are some very small changes in wordings, and then really people are asking, why is there now a difference? Why you're missing here a word, and there's different wording here used, for example, in IFRS 7. using different wordings compared to IS 16 and IS 38, and is this really necessary, or should we have one objective and disclosure requirements, and then you don't have this kind of need to repeat this? You could, of course.
So the second approach is more the centralization of the disclosure requirements.
I think it should try to avoid to redevelop dissimilar disclosures again and again.
Gary?
Thank you. Just a couple of comments, Holger. I think, first of all, I do support the notion of a one central set of disclosure objectives that sort of, you know, for the most part, will cover almost all current or future standards. I think I think we'll streamline our processes. So for every standard after standard, we'll have to redo the same thing. You know, sort of give a stake in the ground for preparers and auditors and others what they could expect in the future. I think our standards and our process can be labored at times. I think anything that can help to streamline it would be useful. And then plus that would allow us to focus all the disclosure time on the more specific stuff relevant to the standard. So I look at the two approaches, and I actually don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive. There's certainly plenty of overlap. I think the first approach is probably more what people are currently used to seeing, but I would also probably point out not a lot of people are happy with how it exists today. Now, it might have nothing to do with the items that are in Table 1 as opposed to how you apply materiality and how we write standards, but although somewhat breakthrough, I think the second approach, I absolutely would support putting in the discussion documents, is I think most of what we do will go through the conceptual framework. The general purpose external reporting is about to help users assess future net cash flows, and if the stuff on pages 14 and 15 achieve that objective, I think that's what we're here to do. I mean, preparers don't need the information. I mean, technically, the auditors don't need the information. They just verify the information. It should be about the users, but I don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive. I think second approach would be difficult to do. There'd be a learning curve. It'd probably take several or more standards to kind of refine it, but I think it's worth putting in the putting out in the paper, because I actually wouldn't object to trying to find a way to get there, assuming, you know, it does hit, you know, your objective of how users commonly assess the, you know, future cash flow prospects.
I find that the approach is very useful. I find that the way it is expressed in paragraph 32 by the New Zealand Accounting Standards Board is quite a rational way to proceed and to meet the objective of 29A. Looking at the way you translate that into the table one, two comments. One, I think, and this is true also for paragraph 32, one element which I think is really missing here in both the objectives of the table is a description of key events and transactions that took place during the reporting period, which have a significant impact on the financial position, financial performance, etc. Because this is very good in a static environment. Last year was comparable to this year, and so you don't need to focus on that. But very often, and the groups are changing quite a lot, acquisitions, divestments, changes in circumstances, and that having a focus maybe in the first box, reporting entity where you have little C activities, maybe you could add and significant events and transactions which really need to be understood by the user of the financial statements to understand the financial position. Now, in the way you explain in the right-hand column the objectives, I think it's good, but it's a bit too aspirational. And maybe going back to what Sue said, if that was a standard instead of some form of guidance, I think most entities would not be able to meet that objective, to meet that standard. Take an example. You have a box which says to identify classes of elements that may contribute to future net cash inflows differently, for example, based on persistence, etc. That's a full financial analysis of the company. That's the role of financial analyst. I agree that preparers should help financial analysts do their job, but to translate the objective of financial analysis into the notes to the financial statements and make it a standard is just impossible to meet the objective.
I suppose that what that was trying to bring out was what we tend to do with disaggregation. We tend to disaggregate either just to show a straight disaggregation of what was in the primary financial statement, but often we split, you know, by counterparty type. And I see your point, and maybe it goes to Sue's point about whether this sits in a standard or as a framework, because as a framework I'd expect the board to be thinking, well, if I'm going to require a disaggregation on a particular risk, why am I doing it? Am I trying to get a particular...
I understand that the financial statements, the structure, and the notes can help a little bit in going towards that kind of information, but an asset may respond, a class of asset may respond to different types of risk in a different manner. It's not that simple. It's not, you know, one asset, one type of risk. If you take the fixed asset of an oil company, how many different factors can affect the cash flows? The dollar rate to the euro, the price of the Brent, the geographical, the geopolitical events, the demand in the market, all those four different types of risks will have different impact on that class of assets. So to say that goes to that box and that responds to this type of risk is a bit too easy to write, but certainly quite difficult to do in practice. Also, you have this objective of identifying elements not in the primary statement that may contribute to affect current and future net cash flows. Well, I have all my research and development for the next 10 years. I have all my development plans. Should I go into describing those elements which are not recognized that may affect current and future cash flows? Certainly not current, but future cash flows. I mean, we have to try to limit a little bit the ambition. Financial statements cannot tell everything. Our chairman wrote an excellent report saying that some time ago.
Really? What did I do?
FCG. You wrote a good report, the Financial Crisis Advisory Group.
Oh, yes.
And you wrote something says financial statements cannot tell all the story.
Yeah.
So I think we should not create an expectation here that people will not be able to meet. Let's be reasonable. What can financial statements say? And not more than that.
I mean, in, to some extent, the general disclosure standard may not need to include that. It could just take, if we're going to follow this approach, and I think this was what was proposed in the conceptual framework, was that it would just list the type of information that you would see in the financial statement. And then it would then be up to the individual standards when they pull down and try and explain that type of information to articulate the purpose of why that type of information was being or required. Now, I think the column in the right-hand side, the purpose was trying to articulate that, but I get your point that if you put it in a general standard, it might be then a general requirement that people have to fall back to.
Even the middle column, nature, function, and extent of unrecognized elements. That is already quite a lot, because there are a lot of things which are resources which will never be recognized. And so how far should a company go in disclosing in the notes all the resources which are not recognized?
So
the value of management. Should there be a note explaining the value of the key management team?
So would you prefer that if we were going to take this approach that we would just have the type of information which is effectively the left-hand column?
I want to say that we should be more restrictive a little bit in what we try to do.
Doug? Thank you. I strongly support second approach. We definitely have to include this approach in our future discussion paper. As Ian pointed out, we are not destroying the structure. We are creating new different structures. The current structure is standard-oriented structure. So it is beneficial for standard setter. However, it wouldn't be beneficial neither to users to preparers. I mean, if we have clear objective, the structure should be objective-based structure. I think it would be very hard for the standard setter to create such a objective-oriented structure. because we have to check all the standards and we have to consolidate it into the one requirement. However, it would be much more useful than current structure. Therefore, I strongly support your courage and your proposal. And but the challenge we have to overcome is what is the minimum requirement of the disclosure? It could be obscured. It would be very difficult to find out what is the minimum requirement of disclosure. And then also, in terms of auditability, maybe auditor would face the difficulty how to check, how to assess this is this meets the standards, because auditor has to audit based on the each standards. So therefore, it's a challenge. However, I really support your approach.
I personally feel, you know, Google, you mix two important things together. Firstly, if you look at paragraph 2.8b, you know, it looks like, you know, the how we, you know, grouping information in a note. You said one is based on element, another one is based on cash flow, you know, operating, financing, and investing. So this is one side, you know, how should we grouping, you know, the information in the notes. And another one is whether we should have integrated principle-based new disclosure standards. I think these are totally different things. Since Taka strongly supports the second issue, I'm strongly against. For two reasons. Firstly, as Sue said, it's too ambitious. You know, we have so many disclosure requirements, you know, it will be extremely hard to arrive that objective, even until all of us be tired from the board. And secondly, last meeting or 2 months ago, I give one example. We have a general requirement, general principles, both in the conceptual framework, IS1 and IS8, related to compatibility, related to retrospective applications of any statement. But recently, in many of our new important standards, we give exceptions for this reason and another. So, you know, leasing, financial instruments, and revenue, we all said, you know, a company can choose either, you know, fully using retrospective approach to disclose competitive information, or alternatively, to use a simplified ones, which is tailored one by one based on the standards. And this is the second reason I feel very hard. Even we can arrive such a principle-based principles or set of principle disclosure. And then when we set standards for a particular specific standards, we will deviate naturally for different reasons. And so I will be strong against, you know, Taka. If you intend to finish before you retire, I'm happy to see. And secondly, between the two approach, I agree with Gary. It should not be one side at all. They are not mutually exclusive. Look at the current standards. You know, if we agree the proposal from New Zealand and France, you remember the general principle is to explain the effect of something on financial position, performance, and cash flow. And there are three aspects: position, performance, and cash flow. And if you want to, you know, apply the objective to everywhere, then I think these two should be there, not only one side, which purely based on position, or purely based on cash flow. You understand what I would say? And also, please don't forget, we failed in the financial statement project. You know, we try to use, you know, cohesive approach that people generate against, and also more tentatively decide to have roll forward based on balance sheet. But, you know, we don't finally publish the ED. But in recent debate, it obviously people will not favor roll forward in all of the standards, and which, you know, PET will like very much. But people will not generally accept we will have roll forward either based on cash flow or based on element. So I don't think that I want to say these two approach are not, as Gary said, mutually exclusive.
Okay, can I just reply with a few things on this? I think very valid points. The first thing, I think with this discussion, this paper, it was not our intention to force some kind of structure to the notes, because I think if the entity still thinks it is more relevant to disclosure maturity analysis for lease liabilities on page 20 in the notes and a maturity analysis for financial liabilities on page 50, that's fine. So we don't want to enforce this, but I think what we try to say is it really necessary to repeat to develop a maturity analysis disclosures for financial liabilities, for lease liabilities, and so on. So therefore, we think it is maybe more the thinking to whether you have a single disclosure objective, and then you don't need to repeat every particular project to develop this for particular line items again.
But it's more a question of slimming down our standards than a question of slimming down the financial statements.
Of course, yeah, that's what we say also with streamlining the disclosure guidance in a way that, you know, you make the list shorter, but you're not really reducing information for users. The other thing is financial statements presentation. We discussed this internally, whether this approach too would give you more sense of this is financial statement presentation. I think, first of all, we have to remind ourselves that what was proposed in the financial statement presentation, most parts came from the user side. So therefore, and I think also we have to remember that the most concerns about financial statement presentation was really a very rigid cohesiveness principle, a direct cash flow method, and a very detailed line item disaggregation. So, but I think on the general view is whether, you know, it's more useful to think about activities. I think there was also some kind of support. And the last thing with roll forward, I think I completely agree with you. Yeah, what we tried, for example, with the Appendix D was to illustrate that we want to make sure that, you know, you could easily argue if you require roll forward for IAS 16 or for assets in the balance sheet, you would need to require this for all the line items. But I think this was more to illustrate, you know, this would be a roll forward requirement for operating assets that the entity used to generate future revenues. So, for example, what you would not derive from this roll forward requirement would be this kind of typical contract assets that would result from IFRS 15. You would not really provide a roll forward because this is not really assets that generate future revenues. And therefore, I think that's a very good question. And I think that this is a really tricky question with roll forward requirements. What is the objective of a roll forward? Is it just to understand the measurement and recognition process? I think this is typically more in light of an insurance project where you really want to understand what happens in the measurement and recognition side. But on the other side is really whether you have this kind of operating assets, you really more want to understand what happens to your operating assets that actually the company is using to generate future revenues. So this kind of information. And therefore, I think this is exactly where I think we need to have more thinking about what is really the objective of this kind of roll forward. And therefore, we illustrated with the Appendix D that, you know, you could really draft it in different ways. But on the other side, if you come to a conclusion, okay, for IAS 16, a roll forward is necessary, then I think you would need to include it for all other assets on the balance sheet side. But this Appendix D should give you more sense how more detailed, more specific could you do guidance without requiring every roll forward for every line item.
Mary?
Couple of points. First of all, specific question from the staff. I think it would be worth exploring in the discussion paper both alternatives rather than picking one and putting only that one forward.
Sure.
I think it would be helpful to maybe distinguish between them more, because I found with flip the appendices coming after, it was hard to follow exactly which was amplifying. And I think maybe also exploring this point about whether they are mutually exclusive, because even, frankly, if we ended up pursuing more an approach one path, I think there's a very basic point about, let's have a single formulation of requirements that relate to whether it's roll forwards or restrictions, et cetera, so that you don't send people saying, what's the significance of having these four words different between, the liens on PP&E and the liens on intangible assets? Are they meaningful or not? I would have a concern with what's shown in Appendix C, I think it is. If we just had the discussion of encumbered assets once in a general standard, and left it to judgment to say when does this kick in, I think what we'd have to do, and maybe this starts going a little way to Sue's change management point, is if we drafted a centralized disclosure requirement once, then I would think in each of the standards in which we have tailored requirements, we would say also consider whatever we agree coming out of this morning's discussion with New Zealand, consider the relevance of the encumbered asset disclosure that's parked over here, rather than just leaving it to people to remember that that might apply. Now, in terms of approach one and table one, I struggled with it a bit because it seems to start with results and then work backwards to what we might be trying to achieve with them. Mm-hmm. And I think both for us to challenge us ourselves to think about what we want to do, and to help people, we should start with objectives, which is maybe column three, and then talk about how you might achieve them. Because I think it would force us to say, what do we want to achieve with disclosures in order to satisfy the overall objective? And then what are the tools that we have to achieve them? Because right now it kind of reads as a justification for what we require today rather than a trying to get to the heart of what we're trying to achieve. So those are a couple of thoughts about these.
Peter.
I think the paper identifies a fundamental problem we have with disclosures, which is that they're fragmented across, 30 different standards. And I think that causes problems for preparers trying to develop the disclosures. I think it causes problems with us with the focus in developing the disclosures, because I think what we have in mind is the particular standard we're working on rather than the whole package. I think the paper ought to discuss a more radical alternative, which is to move all the disclosures into a single standard, so that we can then develop a suitable structure there that integrates them all, and so that we keep them all in mind as we go through. I think we've seen in some of the discussion around the table some of the difficulties of moving the objectives into a single standard, but then trying to keep bits and pieces of disclosures in a series of 30 different standards. So I would discuss a more radical alternative as well, which is to move everything to one place.
Would that solve the how would you, in such an approach, solve the problem of specific standards needing some specific disclosures?
Well, I don't think it necessarily has to be organized by standard. We've discussed, for example, the encumbered assets, which first came up in a particular standard, but then similar questions come up in other places. So we develop them by convenience, by standard, because that's the way we organize them, and that's partly tack's point. That suits our convenience, but it's not necessarily the best way to develop them, and it's not necessarily the best way to package them up once they've been developed. So if we have a disclosure on, rate regulated assets or something, yes, of course we would develop that in the project. We would slot that into a suitable place in the structure, which might be a subsection about rate regulated assets, it might be a section about operating assets, it might be whatever it is, but we would develop the structure in the best way that suits the overall package.
So it would be a standard with the general disclosure guidance principles that pertain to all standards, and then have subsections.
That's right.
But by standard,
that's right. Or not necessarily by standard, but by could be by activity, could be by topic, or it could be a mixture of those, depending on what's going to work best. I mean, I'm a bit sceptical about the operating, financing, investing, whether those would be the most useful subsections, for example. But there are different ways we could do it.
Sue?
I don't disagree with that. It might help us with the discipline in terms of having thought of the overall structure, because I think the main benefit that might come from that would be making us step back and then holistically decide how to pull everything together. But I think it still would be incumbent on us to change our thinking, if you like, and I'll use IFRS 7 as an example where we have got all financial instrument related disclosures in one place. We're still constantly criticised, probably fairly, for having a bad habit of making consequential amendments to IFRS 7 that just focus on the change that we're making now and not taking the opportunity to step back and make sure that it now makes sense in the context, because we still have this sort of standard based focus. So I think it might help us, but it wouldn't in itself be enough unless we change our thinking as well.
We have discussed then, and we felt that they don't necessarily need to have a physical one standard. What would be important for preparers and for the board is to be able to see the disclosures in one place. Now that could be one standard, and I think there'd be a lot more discipline around it, but we could also create views of disclosures with that view, so we could make sure that that was considered when you set standards, and that was something we were thinking of in this review of these extended standards. That we do, I think, because they're individually developed in standards, which has benefits because you're very much close to the recognition and measurement and you're in the detail of what that topic is based. But I think it's also important, as you say, to take that step back. Now that could be one standard or it could be a way of viewing as one standard, and I think they would both achieve the objective. I suppose to your point, we would need the objectives, and this is part of what we're trying to do here, of how you would combine it to get that view.
Gary?
Just a few more thoughts. I think as I look at table one for, I guess, approach one, I mean, that seems it's very much business as usual and sort of status quo. And I was doing myself an earlier talk as preparers. We sort of flipped into, we think, approach two about how users assess prospects for future cash flows. Might be, there's probably a very, we strongly support it. And although this is focused on users, just make an observation, I think preparers look at the accounts the exact same way. It's not so much what's there, it's when's it going to become cash or funds, depending on your liquidity focus. And then it's also what's the exposure? Is that the number or the amount that's going to come through, and the exposure, whether it's risks or uncertainties or some other question mark about it. So it's not dissimilar from a good internal management process, I think, in many cases. However, approach one is much more traditional. But as we write our position paper, I guess discussion document, I think we need to step back and think, who uses this stuff? But I go back, we've already defined primary users as reasonably sophisticated analysts with reasonable knowledge of business and accounting. So when you go through that, I think you care more about what's not there, risks, judgments, uncertainties, and stuff like that, than what's there. So if you're an analyst and you're analyzing financial institutions, I think you should be able to reasonably assume that you expect you're going to have interest income. If you label a line item, investments held to maturity and amortized cost, I don't think you need to know a lot more about that. So that would get rid of some of the measurement assumptions, judgments. You could minimize that. But what might be much more relevant for the originations this year is what's the effective yield on those. Might be a much more meaningful level of information that ties into helping me assess future cash flows, because I know what yield at least the recent purchase is likely to do. So,
Jang Wu.
Thank you. I generally agree with Mary's and Gary's that we need to explore these two approaches in the discussion paper. But I'd like to suggest one more thing on the management stewardship. That's a paragraph maybe 39 and 44, 45. It seems to me information for evaluating the stewardship mainly relate to the profit and loss. So I'm saying there's some information on there in the paragraph 45 is very, it looks like a very narrow interpretation of stewardship. Actually, so I'm suggesting, maybe to rethink about what information is useful for evaluating the stewardship. And I would suggest, maybe based on many members' comments, rather than using some kind of users, assessment of future net cash flows, we'd rather use some kind of objective-based approach, because we don't have to differentiate these two objectives clearly. This one is also related to the table one in page 13. Just there's only one very small element, the segment of this of total table one, related to the narrow scope, kind of narrow interpreted stewardship information. I'm saying all information are related to this evaluation of the stewardship as well as assessing the future.
Just very briefly, I think it's a very good point, and I think we need to check this with also the conceptual framework team, because we read some papers in context of disclosure framework efforts where this kind of stewardship management disclosure, they also consider this kind of disclosure to be part of management stewardship and therefore a little bit separate. So I think it depends also how you understand stewardship level. Is mainly the kind of information or the information you need for owners and management, so that you really see this from a more purely a contracting perspective for owners and management and making this kind of decisions, or whether you think stewardship should be something more broad. I think that's something we need to clearly identify. And we also use carefully the wording mainly used for stewardship, because of course there's also information that is really focusing mainly on stewardship, but it also helps you to prospect future cash flows. But it is really, let's say, the related party disclosure is really in the first place mainly for stewardship purpose, but it also helps you to prospect future cash flows.
I understand what you're trying to do. So you use the mainly that phrase or main.
We don't want to have to exclude.
Yeah, I agree, but that might cause some kind of misunderstanding of the importance of stewardship. That's what I'm saying, because you are just narrowing down all the information in a very small part for this stewardship evaluation. That's what I'm saying. I understand what you're trying to do, but not to look light on important.
Yeah, I agree. Okay,
Mary, and then let's try to answer the questions.
Just picking up on the challenge that Peter offered to also explore a more radical approach, is Peter's maybe the idea the extreme of the second approach? Because I think the second approach is saying centralize some disclosure requirements that appear in multiple standards, and I think Peter's is saying this is the end, so I think we could explore it in that context. I didn't want to lose sight.
So your point was that we should include perhaps that discussion in the discussion paper as well?
I think if we don't do it now, we lose the chance to do so. So maybe we need to think more rather than just responding at the table about whether we include that. But I think rather than it being a third and wholly different way, it's maybe
an extension.
A variant of second approach.
Yeah.
Okay. So first of all, we still need to answer question one, I believe, which is whether we follow the proposed description of the role of the notes in paragraph 24. All in favor? No.
12.
That's enough. Then we go to question 2 and 3.
Question
2 is a bit funny indeed. Yeah. Would the objectives also be? I would like to think that all we do is not just useful for users, but also for preparers. to tell you the truth.
Whether it's useful for just for us.
Yeah, so it's the question is whether we need this in a general disclosure standard, because if this is not going to be useful for preparers and people using the standards, but it's more something for that the board will use internally, we don't need it. I would say we don't need it in the standard itself.
And we have the conceptual framework for that.
Exactly.
I don't disagree with that, but we should recognize that standards are for users, are for preparers and users.
Okay.
For ourselves, we have a due process handbook, we have a constitution, we have a framework, but we don't put our own requirements in our standards. So, I mean, as a side effect of having a requirement for preparers, we can say it's also useful for us, but if we want to achieve that objective, it should be somewhere in our framework, not in a standard.
I thought that was the question, as we're asking whether or not we want to make this available for preparers to use, or whether we want to almost put it into a handbook as just for us.
I think we should, because we'll get the same discussion as with the conceptual framework, which we first said it's only for us, and the whole world said no, it's also for us as well. So do we say yes?
Two more came up.
12. Yeah. And then finally, do we agree that both views should be exposed?
No, they both put their hands up.
Yes. Okay. Then we continue with aggregation of information, paper 11C.
Good morning, everybody. So, agenda paper 11C, we're going to discuss two issues mainly. The research and thought on the principles of disclosure and on the materiality project has made us think on the guidance that we have on IS1 for both aggregation and materiality, and new developments in the POD project and the evidence we have from materiality research were the main drivers we have here. And the new developments we're talking about from POD is mainly what was just decided now, but the role of the notes. And we had a March board paper to decide what are the role of the primaries. So there is difference. There are different roles in there. So we're going to approach considerations on when to present separately an item on the primary or not, and mainly relates to aggregation. And we're also going to approach the level of detail that an entity needs to provide to meet the disclosure requirement. So on the first issue, paragraph 24 highlights our concern that we have by the expression sufficiently material that we have in IS1 now. And it kind of comes back to Tak's comment on the previous discussions that we had about having a different threshold of materiality for notes and for the primaries. And we don't think there is a different threshold. What we think is that the materiality assessment serves a different role. So it serves the role of the primary, which is different from the role of the notes. So we think that expression can create confusion. So we have a recommendation in paragraph 28. The kind of thinking we want to exemplify is in paragraph 28. So in paragraph 28, we have an example of PP&E, which is usually used as an example of aggregation and materiality. And in paragraph 30, we try to amend IS1, and we recommend to amend IS1 in a way that would enable the kind of thinking that we express in paragraph 28 of the paper. So if we could move to the first question, which relates to recommendation in paragraph 30 of amending IS1 or a future disclosure standard. Does the board agree with the staff's recommendation?
I just want to clarify my understanding. Is the proposed amendment that you're talking about here coupled with the drafting that you have in paper 11D? It is.
Yes.
It is. Okay. This is exactly the issue that I was discussing before, which elicited a very strong response from the chairman. On the one hand, I completely agree about the messaging that we should be encouraging companies to only include useful, relevant information, use judgment, and minimize the use of things that are not relevant. Absolutely agree. What I'm not on board with is changing the definition of materiality along the lines in a paper 11D, okay, that says the following. It says information is material if omitting, misstating, or obscuring it could reasonably be expected to influence decisions primary users general financial statements make on the basis of financial information about a specific reporting entity. Then down in 28D, we describe a scenario that might obscure information, hence violate the principle of materiality. This worries me quite a bit because I think it will lead to unnecessarily and frivolous litigation against companies, and hence their investors will bear costs that they shouldn't have to. So I use the extreme example of a Deutsche Bank that chooses to include a reconciliation of PP&E, and some imaginative plaintiff's lawyer says that was immaterial information, it's obscuring, okay, my decision, my judgment, and hence now I have to be worried about
This can only happen in the United States.
Including, well, it could be. But I think it could happen in other markets as well. So I'm on board with this as long as we're not talking about materiality essentially in the context of including additional information that is going to potentially be argued is immaterial and hence obscuring, you know, the messages or signals that are supposed to be provided in the financial statements. I think that's dangerous. That's a bridge too far. That's a bridge too far, and I'd be surprised if the big four general counsels aren't all over this. They're going to smother this. They're going to go crazy. If they don't, they're not doing their jobs.
So if I can reply on this, so paper 11B bundles together the proposed amendments we have for this paper, which is 11C,
right.
For the paper that's going to be presented, I think, in the next session, which is 11B. So I think all of the comments relate to the definition of materiality that's going to be discussed by the audit staff on 11B.
However, though, you confirmed, I asked the question before I made my speech, that paragraph 30, okay, says in determining whether an item is material for purposes of the primary financial statements, you consider the following factors, and you're talking about materiality in the context of your proposed amendment in paper 11D. You shook your head and said yes. That's the reason why I cannot agree with this proposal. I can't answer yes to the staff's recommendation in paragraph 30 for that reason.
Okay.
Stephen?
So paragraph 28 that you pointed out, and the fifth line, you said, the same would not be expected of an entity that's not PP&E dependent. Can you have something that is where PP&E is material, but the entity is not PP&E dependent? What I'm trying to get at is this idea of is a dependency on something for the business an alternative to materiality, or is it the same thing as materiality?
I think what we meant by this paragraph, it's kind of the same thing. It was more like a conversation with the board to show this, the way of thinking, and we put a construction company against a financial institution, and it relates to the same materiality assessment. So when we say PP dependent, we're kind of already giving the example and already giving a conclusion that is not material. So just in the sense to talk to you.
So why change the concept of materiality? Why try and express it in different words? Is it because we just don't think people are applying materiality right, so we're trying to express it in different ways? Or are we really trying to make a change?
No, I think the use of dependent was just to, okay. Maybe it was a poor choice of words, but it was meaning just material.
Yeah,
or not
it is, because, you know, even a bank does need tables and computers, so they are always. I couldn't think of any company that is not to some extent PP&E dependent.
Well, I think that goes back to what should you assume people already know or just believe is there, and you assume everyone in the bank's got a PC.
That's right.
You know, you need a lot of information about that. Probably not.
Yeah. Alan said we're not earlier. Depending on furniture.
They can outsource the cloud computing. They don't have,
we can
also have any.
We can do our meeting sitting on the floor.
And on paragraph 30, what you really want to change, I'm really struggling with the last two sentences, because I understand that we maybe should give some guidance that if touching materiality, depending on its primary financial statements or notes, but then we are saying an entity should also consider any presentation and disclosure objectives in IFRS that are applicable to that item, and then finally an entity considers whether an item is material by taking into consideration the financial statements as a whole. So what we are doing here. I think first we're saying, okay, we should distinguish, but then we're saying we should consider it as a whole, and so it is a little bit, we want to help, but really we don't help, because we then bring it back to the overall objective. And if I have to apply that as a preparer, I would struggle with that, because what should I do? Should I consider everything, or what should I do? I think I agree with the first, but I'm really struggling with the last two sentences, because I think it will not add, because it brings it back what we're trying to explain in the first sentence, and because maybe we are not so sure that we really rely on that, and then we give them this overall stuff which is really then not helpful.
I think from the finally on, which is this last sentence, I think I agree with your point. The one before, an entity should also consider presentations, scores, objectives, I think it's kind of related in a line with the including objectives thinking that we just discussed in the last.
Yeah, but what is it? Because man, I think
just to make entities think on the objectives that maybe eventually we'll have in the future standards.
Yeah, but isn't that clear that you always should? For me, it does not add anything. And
yes, a bit stating the obvious.
Yeah. Okay. And the last sentence is then, okay, that brings back what we are saying in the first sentence, so I don't agree with the last and the second last sentence. Just because it doesn't add to me anything, the second last sentence.
I mean, it's something we can look at in the draft, in particular,
yeah.
Maybe we could rely on the discussion that we're having on the materiality. So, to your point, if we feel this is adding information that's repeating, I mean, it's really trying to describe some of the thinking we've had on materiality, which is you do need to take that step back. You do need to consider an item not only in the context of the primary financial statements or the single note, but I think you also then need to take that step back and look at the financial statements as a whole. And that's some of the discussions we've had on the materiality.
Yeah, but that is where I'm struggling with, because in the first sentence we say we should distinguish if it is in the primary or in the note. That is my understanding. But then in the last sentence we say no, we should look at it at all. So what should we do? And if we should look at the whole, we don't have to bring the first sentence in, because then it does not matter if it is in the notes or in the
I think you need to do ultimately do both.
Yeah, that's so. That is why we are doing that, because that is my question then.
Sue?
I would have thought, just in response to Martin's question, I would have thought that second to last sentence about considering the objectives would be fundamental to getting this approach that we just went through with the New Zealanders to work, because if we're going to move to being less prescriptive and more objective based, surely in a sense of making materiality assessment in the context of those objectives even more fundamentally important to ending up with a document that we all think is a good communication document that discloses what people need to know.
But isn't that obvious, Sue? Because if you want to judge materiality, don't you have to look at the objective of that disclosure? That is for me not helping, not new, because
I think it's redundant rather
yeah,
than not agreeing
right.
with it.
Mary?
In three points. One is paragraph 25-26. I agree with the staff's identification of the term sufficiently material as giving rise to some problems in terms of people understanding things, but and I can see that we'd want to change it, or think about changing it, but I guess I have some concerns about the staff conclusion in 26 that materiality is an absolute term. And again, because to me, if materiality is absolute, I think that reinforces the wrong message, and that may be some of people's problems behind the paragraph 30 proposals. Because to me, if materiality were absolute on off switch, it either is material, and that to me implies would have to be presented separately in the face of the primaries, versus the judgment that we were talking about when we looked at the examples from New Zealand, for example, as emphasizing the need for judgment to determine how much you have to disclose. I think also it's that judgment that goes to whether it needs to be presented separately on the face, or if it is presented, information is presented about it in the notes, and kind of goes back to your other point about sometimes the notes amplify what's there and, provide insights into how things are measured. So I'm not keen on pursuing, right now I don't get the point of pursuing this notion that materiality is absolute, because I think that reinforces an on-off switch. It either matters or you don't have to deal with it in the financial statements as a whole, as opposed to the emphasis from other discussions about you need to use judgment, having to assess the materiality of something. The other thing is, it's kind of a process point, but paragraph 30, it wasn't clear to me if you were thinking that as part of a discussion paper, we would be exposing specific proposed amendments to IS-1, or if you were saying, if we carry through on these proposals in the discussion paper, ultimately we would be proposing an amendment to IS-1. I think if it's the latter, let's make it clear, because I read it a couple times and I wasn't sure which it was, and I don't think we should let the multiple rounds of changes to standards kind of get ahead of where we eventually land after consultation. So maybe we don't have to be so specific in the wording, although there are times when specific wording does help.
Philippe? A short follow-up on Mary's point. Also, I think that to say it's black or white, is either material or not, is not very helpful, because when it is material, it can be moderately material or very, very, very material. So if you have two items, one is moderately material or material enough to pass the test, and the other one is very, very material, would we expect an entity to present those two different facts in the same way? Or to put more emphasis on the one which is very, very material by presenting it differently in terms of order of importance, in the ranking of the notes, in the way they communicate about it. So this is to reinforce that I think it's not a black or white situation. It's either it is below the threshold or it is above. But then when it is above, maybe you should consider how material it is.
I'm trying to imagine a standard that says very material, very, very material, and extremely material. It's to us, it's the context, and that if it's to use your words, very, very material, then it probably means that it's important enough to go. Sorry, but I use that word. It goes on. if you look at the objective of the primary financial statements, it's material within the context of the primary financial statements. And other cases that you don't need to put all of that detail on the primaries, but it's material in the context of the notes, because the whole package as a whole provides now with information to meet the needs of investors. So it's not about making very material, it's materiality in relation to a particular objective.
Yeah, but take this in the context of the World Disclosure Initiative, which is to better communicate, to discuss how to best present the notes. It's not an on-off switch. There is more to it.
But I think a decision about whether information should be included or not ultimately is an on-off switch.
No, it's
so
entry point.
Should it be in there or it should not be in there?
It's entry point, sure. But it's not an absolute measurement. I mean, okay, you could say it's an absolute term, because if it is not material, forget about it. If it is material, we can't forget. But I think we should not convey an impression that it is just... It's so simple as to say yes or no. There is more to it.
I suppose I didn't, maybe I didn't mean, we didn't mean that by absolute. We meant that it was either material and then you need to be including it somewhere, somehow. If for the purpose, the context you're looking at, either the primary or the notes, it's material, it should be in there. I think it's a separate question, yeah. How much emphasis. It's not to say that it doesn't require judgment and it won't be a decision, and there could be a range of views as to whether it was or it wasn't.
Yeah. The second point, I have hard time to reconcile this notion of one assessment of materiality in absolute terms
with the fact that we seem to indicate that there are two levels of metadata, one for presentation on the face and one for presentation in notes.
What we're saying is there's a different purpose. So the primary financial statements are to create a summary. And so therefore, if you've got, you know, and I'm going to say it in paper terms, if you've got one page to describe your position or your performance, certain you're going to describe certain things in that. And therefore, you know, you're going to bring out something, and for that purpose, that information will be material. It's not to say that something more granular wouldn't be, and that would be the notes do.
This notion of one absolute term, an absolute term, as expressed in 26, actually, in practice, you will apply two different tests. One, is it material enough to be presented on the face? If not, then you go to the notes. Is it material enough to warrant a disaggregation in notes? If not, you forget about it. But there are two levels of materiality in practice, as we say in a paragraph 30. So it's kind of contradictory to an absolute term.
Yeah, you're almost, I think, in the footnotes, maybe material is the wrong word, but maybe still required disclosure to achieve the objectives of the notes. I mean, it might be as opposed to material to achieve the objective of notes. I don't know if that would help, but I think that's the point you're trying to get at. It might be required. Forgetting whether it's material, required, important, it's necessary to achieve the disclosures, objectives of the individual footnotes. I mean, that's what you're really saying.
But I think 25, 26, you hit on the current problem, and in trying to solve it and, you know, squish it, I think it's just going to pop up somewhere else if we keep pursuing this. Is it absolute? Is it relative? Gradients of materiality. Maybe we need to step back, and I mean, this is just throwing out an idea. Step back and say, when you're looking at an event, class of transactions, assets or liabilities, you assess their materiality, and then depending upon that assessment, you might conclude that it needs to be presented on the face, or that on the face it would be included with other items if it's recognized, and then discussed in the notes. It's kind of, it's another way of putting Alan's phrasing of in the context of the primaries in the notes, but maybe we need...
Can you draw a conclusion from this discussion? rather than voting on these...
I get the impression, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that most people were comfortable with what we're proposing up until we get to the last two sentences.
Yeah.
And so I think it's, if we re-look at those last two sentences of those amendments, I think that set out in paragraph 30, whether that's not include them, whether amend them significantly, would people be comfortable with the proposal in question?
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Is that a right assessment?
Yes. Silence is agreement.
Okay.
Then we continue with...
No, there's another issue.
Sorry.
The second issue is the level of detail.
Oh, that one, yes.
And I think it kind of relates a little bit with the discussion we're having here about something being more material or not, and because you might think of something... You might think that something is material, and then there is a disclosure requirement to disclose in the notes, for example. But using Philippe's words, it is so material that you might want to expand that information. Or it's not that material, you still want it there, you might want to diminish a little the size of it. So on the same structure, we have an example in paragraph 41 on the way we think on this issue. And once again, we use the PPE example. So an entity might decide, when deciding if it's going to disclose a PPE, row 4, for example, the entity might decide to do the full reconciliation, which is specifically as required by the standards. It can decide to do a partial one. It can decide to do a very narrative, small disclosure because it doesn't think it's that important. So this way of thinking on disclosure requirements and the application of materiality is something that we try to draw out in paragraph 44 with the recommendation of amending, I think it's paragraph 31 of IS-1, in the sentence left 44. So we included a small sentence in page 14. An entity shall consider the level of detail necessary to satisfy the disclosure requirements. Just to mention, some of our standards already have that, and we already touched this on previous discussion, this consider level of detail expression. So this is our staff recommendation. Does the board agree with it?
Yeah, we agree. All right.
Sorry, Hans, can I?
Oh, yes, you can still disagree. It's too late, but.
No, I don't want to disagree. I'm just questioning one word that you've used throughout this document, and that's the word disaggregation. Because my understanding is that the conceptual framework team have been moving away from using that term. Putting it in here.
I think that the way that the conceptual framework uses disaggregation is slightly different, because the way it uses is to disaggregate a change in asset, for example, and how that flow will affect income. So it disaggregate in the portion that would go to OCI and the portion that go to profit or loss. And if Peter can correct me if I'm wrong. So what we try to use here, the term disaggregation, is not about classification or recognition and measurement. It's mainly disclosure. So it's a breakdown. It's basically a breakdown of information or not.
We felt it was necessary for some disclosures, because some disclosures are a disaggregation of a line item, and their purpose is to disaggregate into components so you can see those components. So we did try to avoid using it, but actually it does describe some of the disclosures.
I should avoid using it. Good. I like the term.
Yeah. But we did try and describe what we meant by it here, and to say that it may have other meanings. But in terms of disclosures, I think there are some specific disclosures which are disaggregations of line items.
Don't we need a short break before we continue with materiality? Really short one, until 10 to 12 on the that part.
we'll just be transparent.
Ian.
Okay, we continue with materiality 11B. Aisling, are you going to?
Yes, so controversial paper. So the issue in this is aligning the definitions across the standards. So our starting point was the conceptual framework ED, and then we considered what we'd learned throughout the disclosure initiative and what we thought we should add in. So we considered if we were happy with the threshold of could, and if there was an overemphasis on ensuring that information is not omitted. So when we looked at the issue of could, we actually wanted it to mean could reasonably be expected to, but we found it difficult to explain that that's what we meant without doubly saying that's what we meant. So we think we should change the phrase, we should just replace could with could reasonably be expected to, as it seemed the most logical way of suggesting it. We then considered whether we should follow the FASB in adopting the US Supreme Court decision. But we thought that this would be a substantial change to our understanding of materiality and that it wasn't necessary. We also considered if the word would be more appropriate, but we, based on our outreach, continue to support the board's decision last November that would is not the appropriate word. So, as has already been discussed, we have added in a reference to obscuring material information. We thought that it would be helpful and appropriate to make clear that material information should be accessible and not overly swamped. So, as a result of that, the staff recommend that the definition should be information is material if omitting, misstating, or obscuring it could reasonably be expected to influence decisions that the primary users of general purpose financial statements make on the basis of financial instruments about specific about a specific reporting entity. We also introduced some clarifying paragraphs. These really just aim to clarify the key characteristics of materiality, and they are laid out in paragraph 40 and were included in appendix or paper 11D. So the questions for you are, do you agree with the proposed definition of materiality in paragraph 35?
I must say that the former naked use of the word could is asking for a lot of trouble, because everything could or can in some circumstances. So I can understand that in practice this has led to a lot of trouble. And I do think that adding reasonably be expected is a big help, and I hope that it will also help people to be a bit more confident about the materiality judgment in practice. So I think it's very important. Secondly, when you look at the Supreme Court, what do you call it, verdict or whatever it is, are the FESB going to literally to take it like this? Because it doesn't seem to me accounting language at all. Mm. On the other hand, you know, when you look at it, it uses would, but in combination with substantial likelihood. So if that is in practice very different from could reasonably be expected, I am not sure. I think the two definitions are very close. Where I have more questions about the Supreme Court words is that they then say as having significantly altered the total mix of information, whatever that may mean. And that's why I think this statement becomes will be problematical in practice in the United States as well. So I wonder how the public will react to this precise saying. But I think the philosophy between the two statements is not so hugely different. But my conclusion is yes, we definitely need to do this to give people a little bit more comfort about materiality. Philippe?
Yeah, more or less the same feelings as the ones expressed by Hans. I would add to it that the US Supreme Court is a jurisdiction for the US. I understand that FSB might wish to be influenced in its definition by that verdict. We are an international organization, so we are dealing with more than 100 different jurisdictions, and the courts in those different jurisdictions will have their own definitions of what is material. So why privilege the US court as a guidance for us? I will not do that, because it may be that a European Court of Justice could come up with a different definition of materiality when applied to IFRS financial statements. We have no experience yet, but wait and see. I think also that, as you said, usually the courts of justice look at financial information in the context of the whole package. My experience as a securities regulator in enforcing pursuits against preparers on the basis of financial statements is that usually the courts do not follow easily the enforcement action when information is disclosed elsewhere in press releases, management commentary, because they consider materiality of information in the whole context, and they don't really focus on what is in the financial statement or the notes. So very often, it's difficult to enforce materiality only on the financial statements, because they will say, but it was disclosed in the speech of the president. Well, okay, but as an enforcer of financial information, you're not happy with that. But you must accept that the court is assessing the whole of the information given to the market. So I think I would take with a lot of caution the decisions by courts.
That is why I think this definition of materiality by the Supreme Court is also problematical for the FESB, because they don't control the whole mix of information.
Possibly true, yes. So I think we should have our own definition when applied to the set of financial statements and not when applied to financial information at large. We are trying to regulate materiality for the financial statements, including the notes. So I like the approach. I'm just a bit uncertain about the term obscuring. And I tried to react as an enforcer, which I was before. It's difficult to assess whether the way you present information, it's easy to see whether it is here or omitted. That's fine. It is relatively easy to determine whether it is properly stated or misstated. Truthfulness of information. Now, when it comes to obscuring, especially when you combine this information with other information which may be less material, you use them swamping it with immaterial information, it's quite difficult to enforce that principle and to make a judgment as to whether that is obscuring. It is very, very judgmental. I'm not saying we should not attempt to do something, but I think we have to think carefully about how to achieve that objective, because this is so judgmental, so subjective, whether the information is obscured a little, a lot.
Would something like misrepresenting be a better word?
Yes, but in a way, misstating and misrepresenting is the same. And I know you want to go a bit further than that.
Which paragraph are you referring?
Yeah, I mean the definition proposed by the staff in 35.
Paragraph 33 also.
33 and the final recommendation, which is paragraph 35, where they propose a new drafting, which introduces the term obscuring it. And it's quite a matter of
35.
In discussion 34, and the end result would be 35. It says omitting, misstating, or obscuring it. Mm-hmm. I'm not against trying to do something, but I really I'm not sure how to achieve that objective with only one word like obscuring, because it's all a matter of degree.
Yeah. I understand what they say. Burying it would be another word.
Maybe it may be difficult to enforce, but possibly it could address the behavioural issues around, because if it's a behavioural issue, it might be there and it might prompt preparers not to obscure, even though the regulator might find it difficult to enforce it.
Well, we can explore that in a discussion paper, but I think we should really ask a specific question on that topic. And I'd like to have a very clear engagement with securities regulators and enforcers on the operationality, and the auditors as well. Because auditors will have first to make a judgment on that, whether it is operational or not.
Gary.
Thank you. Number of comments. One is, I don't think the FASB has any choice but to go with the U.S. Supreme Court definition, and I do appreciate Ainsley that. Is your analysis says, well, their requirements came out of, you know, sort of different fact cases and context, but let me assure you that's how it's broadly and widely believed, interpreted, obviously the FASB does, because that's the direction they're going. And and it sort of drifts into, when you're on your page, I guess at page 13 under legal basis A4, well, you've got rule 10b-5, that's the general fraud statute in the securities laws, and that's where all the enforcement cases, they end up in there because information is, you made some form of material error of some context. That said, I think the definition you've worked up or proposing is a vast improvement over just could, because anything could happen, as we've discussed before. I do have one question for you that I have different, depending on what you respond to it, then I still have a follow-up separately. So let me just ask the question first. I mean, we're proposing using the phrase reasonably be expected, and I ignored the word would, even though I sort of lost that battle, whereas the U.S. Supreme Court has substantial likelihood. Do you view those as synonymous or about equal, or is that a higher standard? Just
I don't think we ever actively discussed whether we'd use substantial likelihood, because could reasonably be expected to is already in IS1, so we thought it would be appropriate to take from there and put it into
I mean, I'm okay. I think we make proposals of vast improvement. You know, I'm just curious if you view those as equivalents.
And I'd just add as well, it's reasonably expected to such influence decisions,
yeah,
as opposed to the US with high likelihood could significantly, which is actually, we think, is a low threshold in the US, make a small change in the total mix. Mm-hmm. And so, and that was our concern.
So, what are you saying? Is that a lower threshold?
No, they're different sentences. One sentence is about whether you could reasonably expect it to influence a decision. The other one is whether you're going to change the total mix of information in a small way. And I think they're different issues. The US is about whether you change the mix of information, whereas ours is about whether you change the decision that somebody would make. So it's not just a matter of substituting one word, you've got to look at the sentence it's used in.
By the way, Gary, so were you really when you said FASB has no choice?
That's my opinion.
Yeah, but does that mean that we can only have a chance for global standards, global accounting standards, if the whole world uses the words of the Supreme Court of the United States?
I think the context is different, because when you get to the Supreme Court, which essentially public interprets public policy for it, when you're in a court system in a litigation environment, that's very different than preparing materiality for perhaps general purpose financial reporting. It's only when there's a contentious difference of opinion, you know, where you think your rights are being violated. So I think the context is different. I mean, you're not going to have that in the course of your day-to-day preparing your financial statements, interaction with your auditors. So it's pretty important if you end up deep into the federal court system. So I do believe the context is different. I heard, you know, I think it was Russ at one of our ASAP meetings says it's been defined, you know, and they're going to go with the Supreme Court definitions. I think they believe that's where they have to be.
Coming back to what you said, you could even read the Supreme Court formulation as being a lower threshold than ours, since it only says, well, it has significantly altered the mix of information, whereas we say it influences the decisions of the primary users, which is a step further.
Well, the FASB's papers argue that they are the same. But we don't think, we're not that confident about making that.
What are they saying?
That changing the mix and or altering the decisions are the same thing.
I don't think so.
No, but that's their assumption. Mm-hmm. So that's why, this is the whole point, there are differences. To be frank, if I was the FASB, I actually wouldn't define it. If they have a Supreme Court definition, I'd just say material and let the court definition
sit. And perhaps, you know, and that's, I guess, leave their due process to have came to the conclusions they did.
I would certainly use more elegant language and say, well, this jives with the Supreme Court decision, but this is terrible language for an accounting standard, etc.
And again, I think in terms of day-to-day operations, I think we're not working with the highest court of the land's ruling. You're working with something more common sense, you know, that works day-to-day for most people. Just another comment, and I think this came out as something earlier today, when you've got, I'm back in paragraph 35, information is material if omitting, misstating, or obscuring it. It focuses on obscuring. I think that's an important word to get in there, because that's just putting into our scenario the buried facts doctrine that's in common law virtually every place, that basically can't overload the important stuff with a bunch of unimportant stuff, or, you know, put something that's important way in the back or whatever else. It's got to kind of work, and that's just common law doctrine. They did, everybody's got essentially the same common law. So I agree with putting it in.
Do you think it is operational in the, for instance, in the U.S. environment, this notion of obscuring, if you take it to court?
I think it's just consistent with the buried facts doctrine, which, you know, but at least 10 different common laws around the world recognize the principle is just can't, you know, stick something important and muddy it up or put it in the back when it should be more prominent or whatever. I think we want to get the point in is that, no, you can't bury something important in the detail. I think so it's useful to get into my way of thinking.
We're going to have a look at the practice statement as well, we've actually got that in there, I think.
100% consistent with what we did in the IAS-1 proposals at the end of last year.
It's consistent with the IAS-1 proposals at the end of last year.
consistent with 30A.
Yeah, but currently it is a practice statement which has not the same strength as a standard.
No, it's consistent with the wording that we made to the IS1 amendments, which are finalised at the end of the year. We've got similar wording currently in IS1 paragraph 30A.
Stephen.
Whilst I don't think we should adopt the Supreme Court definition, I think there is one aspect of it which
we shouldn't.
There is an aspect of it that I think we ought to consider, and that is the focus on the information relevant to investors in making decisions, as opposed to what we have, which is the impact on the decisions themselves. So that's forcing a preparer to go through some sort of process to identify how the information would affect decisions, or how an investor would think about the information making the decisions. Wouldn't it be simpler for the preparer to say, well, this information could be reasonably expected to be relevant to an investor making decisions, and then stop there?
Then what's relevant to you're going to have to go that step and say, what's that decision? Because information which is relevant to a decision is asking you, what is that decision, or what's going to influence that decision?
I find our proposal much more straightforward.
The sentiment I like, because I know we do often hear from preparers, how do I know what an investor is going to make a decision about? But I'm not sure how we would.
Well,
how we could.
I'm trying to think of a way of avoiding the word could.
So what would you rather have than could?
Could you focus on
could? No, we couldn't.
you.
We wouldn't.
No, we wouldn't.
Okay, go on, Steve.
I'll come back to it.
Think about it.
I've written down some words, but I'm now not entirely sure that they do work, so I'm not going to read them out, but I'll talk to Christy afterwards.
You're not sure that they could influence our decision. Okay. Martin.
I agree with this proposal, but I think this discussion demonstrates how difficult it is for a preparer, because if you are a preparer, for example, you are listed in the U.S. and then you have also to deal with, because if something happens, that is really the Supreme Court who which we judge on your decision on materiality, and then you have guidance from the SEC, and then we have this guidance in our statements. And if we want to change behavior, I think if a preparer in this situation, he would use the most conservative interpretation of materiality, because he don't want to have the risk to be sued in a law suit. And I think that is really the problem. And if we want really to change behavior by materiality, I think we have to work on aligning that with really maybe with the US, with others, because I think that is really the problem which we have. I agree with our definition now, but I think that will not solve the problem, because if you have different definitions and people have to work with that, and I think what, as I said, always, okay, I think people or the preparers want to mitigate this risk, and therefore they disclose more and more and more, because they don't want to have judged differently by a court or anybody. That makes it more difficult if you have different definitions.
I truly think that the proposed definition is substantially aligned with the American threshold, which was also designed to bring it up a little bit.
But you have to, I think it is a good experience if you have to make judgment of materiality with a securities lawyer and then discuss it with an accountant, that is totally different.
Yeah.
That is really, I think, an exercise people have to do and say, if it is aligned, but how people in the law or in the these guys really would look at that is different.
I think before, in the past, we still at present, both boards had a pretty impossible definition, which created a lot of necessity for conservatives. The Supreme Court has brought it up a little bit, and I think we're doing the same. Pat?
I just wanted to come back to the exchange that Gary and Christy had. I agree, Christy, that we've amended paragraph 30. We talk about that in 11C, paragraph 30A. We added that phrase, an entity shall not reduce the understandability of its financial statements by obscuring material information with immaterial. And I'm on board with the direction that we're going here in terms of the proposed changes, with the exception of the word obscurity, or to obscure, more or less for the same reasons that Philippe has articulated, and I've spoken already this morning to. My concern is the way we're defining obscure, and that's, you know, discussed in paper 11D. If the approach was, or the intent was along the lines of what Gary said, which is burying information, you know, on page 400 about, let's say, a major issue, major, you know, cash inflow or cash outflow, that in my mind makes complete sense. That would not be, you know, consistent with the intent of providing useful information. Although, you know, I don't know whether or not a court would be able to convict the company for putting that material information on page 400 as opposed to page 1.
Never.
Probably never. Yeah, exactly. So while clearly that's the spirit, the way you've defined obscure in paragraph 28D is something that I think is imprudent. I don't think we should be going there. And that's why I wouldn't vote for this particular change. If you left it to the omission or misstating, I'd be fine. And I'm on board with the could reasonably be expected. I see the U.S. Supreme Court decision, by the way, as a much higher threshold than this. And we are moving towards that higher threshold, but I still think nowhere near it. There is a huge difference, notwithstanding the translation issues in other languages, there's a huge difference in the English language between the word could and would.
Not in combination, because it's a conditional would.
There's too many conditions, though, in the U.S. Supreme Court decision, I see as making it a much higher threshold.
I don't see it.
If you go back to paragraph 16, you have to have a substantial likelihood. That's one condition. You have to have reasonable investors, and along with having significantly altered the total mix of information. There are so many conditions in there that, in my mind, make that so much higher. So I've always been more sanguine with our approach because I frankly think it serves the investor community more. However, it potentially opens up companies, I think, to more litigation in that respect. So, but when you add obscure to this definition, you have just made this so wide. I'm not in favor of going that far.
I agree with Pat. The objective that we should pursue is not to tell people don't commit a crime. We want to tell people do good communication, which is quite higher in terms of objective than not committing a securities crime. Right. And the court is just looking at securities crime, not at the quality of communication.
That's right.
Mary, Mary?
I support the staff proposal, but I have the same question that I had about some of the other IS-1 amendments in the previous paper. Are we actually going to propose right now to make this change to IS-1, or are we going to say in the principles of disclosure discussion paper, here's one of our objectives, and in order to realize that this is the kind of change we would be thinking at a future date of proposing?
Yes. So
it's the latter?
Yes, the latter, because these amendments are trying to get a visualization of what we're proposing.
Because I think, first of all, I support the change from the kind of naked could wording to could reasonably be expected. I think that we're right to draw on existing language that we use elsewhere. I think we're right to give a bit more context to what we mean by could. And I think we also have to remember that this project is not about clean sheet of paper reconsidering what materiality is. Your objective was to bring consistency across all of our discussions of materiality. So I think for all those reasons, it's the right combination to get people focused on as the eventual outcome. The second issue of obscuring, and whether we use the word obscuring or talk about materiality, also supporting the understandability of financial statements, and I'm not arguing for different, trying to suggest different drafting at this point in time. I actually think, contrary to what Pat was saying, that it's actually quite important that we get a marker for that concept in the discussion of materiality. And I think it's helpful if we're exploring it in a discussion paper to say, here's what we're trying to get to. We have one discussion that's looking at it quickly. The amendment we made to IS-1, paragraph 30, big A, is in the context of aggregation or disaggregation more than it's in the context of how much information are you providing, and by providing so much, are you kind of creating a smoke screen so people don't notice and see the one important piece that's included. I think we do have to communicate that that's a concern, whether we put it in as you've said, omitting, misstating, or obscuring, or whether we said omitting or misstating could reasonably be expected, also should not, then a separate sentence, also should not obscure material information by inclusion of immaterial information. I'm not as fussed which way we do it, but I want a marker for that concept that is very much explored in the draft practice statement. I want a marker in the authoritative literature for that, because otherwise, if we have the discussion only in the practice statement and go ahead with it as a practice statement, I think we'll have a gap. So,
just one follow-up on this obscuring. I think the discussion just highlights that it will be important to make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences. So let's just make sure we focus on that when we're talking to people and getting feedback on the document, because I think some talked about whether it would have been appropriate when we made the IAS-1 amendments to actually prohibit immaterial information being provided, and similar issues came up, but I haven't heard it coming up with this rearticulation, but it's a good opportunity to double check in a discussion paper. The other thing was just wording things, and I don't feel strongly, just to flag them for you to think about if I could. In the context of making amendments to IAS-1, it feels to me a little bit odd to reference a specific reporting entity, not because I disagree with it, but just because everywhere else in IAS-1 we say an entity shall do this, an entity shall do that, and presumably...
I've got a suggestion for that, and it's to do with the draft. The sentence is back to front, that's the problem. So if you started it with information in the general purpose financial statements of an entity, its material, instead of popping the entity in the statements at the end of the thing, put that at the beginning, which is the context.
So I wouldn't want to imply that elsewhere where we say an entity, we don't mean, because I presume when somebody's reading it, they're thinking of themselves when they're applying our standards.
But the concepts are about the financial reports of an entity. So that's
it's
what
always
you start
the
sentence
It's always
with.
The specific entity.
Yeah. But so we can fiddle with that.
It's just a wording thing to think about. And the other wording thing just to think about was, just in the last words in X4 in paragraph 40, where it says obscure material information about issues the entity faces, that sounds awfully broad. Surely in the context of what financial statements are about at a minimum.
Okay, we can do it.
I just didn't want to apply some, on the first one, on the specific reporting entity, it's rather, I don't want to imply that if we haven't used that word everywhere else, we're sort of making general observations when presumably we always mean the entity that's supplying the standard. That was
we go. Let's move on now, guys.
Firstly, I strongly support Philippe's point. Firstly, it's not necessary for us to adopt U.S. Supreme Court views on anything. And secondly, I also agree with him, security regulator or other enforcer may look at information not only from the financial statement, but other source. My question is, if we intend to publish this for comments, and what's the relationship with the conceptual framework ED, which we intend to serve long time? which is different from the proposed wording. Do we, or are we intend also revising the conceptual ED wording? And if that is the case, will we give a comprehensive background why we do so? It seems not so clear to me. So we will expose ED, not change. But at the same time, we expose another materiality definition, proposed change.
But I think, well, this is the question I was asking that Christy confirmed to me, that the wording that we're looking at is not being published. It's not being published as an exposure draft.
Yes.
We are planning. It's saying if we pursue this idea that we're covering in the discussion paper, mm-hmm. here's the type of amendment we think we'd propose.
So it's not an immediate exposure draft.
Does Weigo's point more? Do we need to flag that potentially that may mean we'd need to go back and make a change to the conceptual framework later on?
Yeah, we said in the ED that
conceptual framework ED.
In the conceptual framework ED that we haven't really tinkered with the definition of materiality. We did make one small change to refer to primary users, but we've not tinkered with it apart from that. But we pointed out there's more work going on in the disclosure initiative.
Okay.
That's clear.
All right. Let's try to answer the question. Do we agree with the recommendation for the proposed definition of materiality?
And can I suggest, I think we could get unanimous if we understand the concerns about obscure, and we'll bring those out in the discussion.
Yes,
explain the process of those.
Okay.
Still can't get
12
Yes. And then the
obscure reason.
I'm not a rookie anymore.
The clarifying paragraphs. Question B.
Yeah, there's some reservations on X4.
Yeah.
Okay.
12 and 5.
Now we move to 11D.
11A. We've been going backwards all day.
Okay, due process. For the practice statement. Michelle or Aisley?
Okay, so the paper just sets out the due process steps taken in relation to the practice statement on materiality. And also, particular interest on page 4, the discussion as to why we chose to make it a practice statement and not implementation guidance. And this has been a point which has been brought up in discussion. So we do expect to receive feedback on this point. We've also included an effects analysis and reasons for not including a basis of conclusions. We've chosen a similar comment period to that of an ED for a standard, so it'll be 121 days. So then the questions. Are ISB members satisfied that all due process steps required to date that relate to the publication of the draft practice statement have been complied with?
I have a question. I don't get why no basis for conclusion, especially for the exposure draft.
Second question. Yeah.
But what kind of things would we put in the basis for conclusions if we had one?
I think it's why have we decided that a practice statement is helpful? Mm-hmm. How do you know? Why did we decide to issue it as non-authoritative guidance? You know, why do we think certain descriptions? Guidance, etc., will help resolve what we have identified as the problems that we're trying to answer with this.
But the staff that we've just had.
The staff is proposing to have it as an introduction to the practice statement. It's paragraph 12 here.
But having seen the draft of the practice statement, I don't think I think a very long, several page introduction would be a negative rather than a positive, and I don't think a three paragraph discussion is sufficient to cover our reasoning for all the things that are in there.
Yeah.
So that's why I think an introduction is not sufficient.
Explaining more why we've issued that type of guidance and leaving more of the materiality discussion we had for the discussion paper.
Well, Pat had said including very much the discussion we just had. My understanding is that in the we may have to pick up some of that given the guidance in the practice statement, but I think the more basic point about understandability that's probably in the discussion paper, principles of disclosure discussion paper itself. But it just strikes me as unusual, and just dropping something on people without explanations for all these decisions. Maybe we should look at whether they need to be carried forward to the final, but certainly for the ED, I think we need.
Maybe one reason to go with you would be that the timing of all these initiatives is a bit strange, that we issued a practice statement in advance of all the discussion paper on the disclosure initiative. So it's like putting the cart before the horses in a way. So one way to overcome that difficulty would be to have a basis for conclusions, because it would explain why we issue a draft practice statement now, in advance of the whole discussion on materiality.
So I think it's a reasonable suggestion to have a limited basis for conclusions explaining the issues, including that. Do you agree? So what was the question? The due process, right?
That all due process steps required to date.
Yes.
Okay. All in favour?
Yeah.
So if we change the second one to, do ISB members agree that there should be a limited basis of conclusions?
Yes.
All in favour?
Do ISB members agree with the proposed timetable for publication and give the staff permission to start balloting?
Yeah. All in favour?
Do ISB members agree with the common period of 120 days?
All in favour?
Even if we issue in July.
Oh yeah, even if we issue in July.
You missed that word minimum.
Well, I think we're proposing to issue this in July, and I don't know whether that causes a problem with August being a...
No. I'm pretty sure I don't want to repeat what I said yesterday. All right. We break.